You're listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Daniel Freeb.
Hello, chaps.
Television's Daniel Freeb is back.
You look as though you're in a spaceship.
We are in a spaceship, Daniel. We're leaving. We're
dismayed
leaving Earth.
By today's events. You're trying to leave planet Earth.
We're off. We're back together, the three of us. We were joined by Theatre's Ned Bolting last week, whose tour Bikeology is a roaring success, according to Ned. It looks good, and I think we're going to see it, aren't we, Lionel?
Yeah, are they going to put on the posters, Bikeology by Ned Bolting, a roaring success, Ned Bolting?
Maybe. Well, listen, this is a regular weekly podcast about cycling, but there's not a lot of cycling happening at the moment, so Daniel had the mad suggestion that we would just do a free-flowing, see-what-happens sort of podcast.
Worrying.
Well, these are worrying times, aren't they?
A whimsical monologue.
I mean, do people not realise that everything's scripted? I mean, this bit here is scripted. I've scripted this bit now.
Yeah. And well, that's not strictly true, but normally we come in with a little bit of a plan, and we do have a bit of a plan because we've got some interviews this week. I was away in Gran Canaria with Alberto Contador recently, just the two of us and a few others, and I've got an interview with Alberto Contador, a rare chance to hear him speak in English. He speaks very good English. We've got a bit of Filippo Pozzato from the Ruler Classic. Whoa. And in the final part, we'll also hear from Megan Garnier, the winner of the inaugural Women's World Tour.
What better rider to feature on a rambling, shambolic, aimless podcast than Filippo Pozzato?
Well, I hope he's not listening.
Did he win the Ruler Classic? Is that his first win in 5 years?
Certainly, he was very in demand. There were a lot of autograph hunters, selfie seekers, congealing around Filippo Pozzato.
Three stages, wasn't there, at the Ruler Classic, Thursday, anyway, Friday, Saturday?
He tells us exclusively that he is going to win his second Milan-San Remo next year, 2017. So that's a bit of exclusive news. So speaking of news, Lionel, one bit of furniture that we do have in this week's podcast that we do need to get through is the news roundup.
Shoot. Yeah, indeed. Well, as you say, Rich, not an awful lot going on in the world of cycling at the moment, but there was the first round of the UCI Track World Cup Series in Glasgow in the Sir Chris Hoy Velodrome. Some of the highlights included a win in the individual pursuit for the veteran French road rider Sylvain Chavanel. We hadn't anticipated him taking to the boards anytime soon, particularly not in an event where he could just get in a break and ride to a comfortable victory. But he's won the individual pursuit there. The recently unretired Cameron Meyer won the points race, but probably the most dramatic moment of the weekend was in the Women's Madison, the first ever elite Women's Madison at World Cup or World Championship level. And there was a crash for the British pair, Katie Archibald and Manon Lloyd, but they recovered to win the inaugural Women's Madison. Talking of track racing, and only a couple of weeks after I spoke in such glowing terms about the forthcoming Revolution Champions League series, unfortunately, the opening round in Paris has been cancelled. So the series will kick off in Manchester at the end of November, followed by a round in London in December. And that pretty much confirms what we already know, which is that track racing is very much a British sport, isn't it? Very, very popular here in the UK, perhaps less so elsewhere. We gather that the reason for the cancellation is a lack of ticket sales, despite cutting prices for the Paris event. On the road, it's been confirmed that the World Tour next season will consist of 18 teams, and that means that Dimension Data and Mark Cavendish's team will continue in the World Tour. There'll be no relegation. But the aim by the UCI is to reduce the size of the World Tour to 17 teams in 2019 and then 16 teams from 2020 onwards. So we've got a long, slow, protracted game of musical chairs to look forward to over the next few seasons. A little bit of transfer news. World points race champion John Dibben is joining Sky next season. Talking of Sky, their team principal Dave Brailsford will be summoned to speak to MPs, a culture, media and sports select committee hearing into doping and cycling. And finally, Alex Dowsett says he is going to target the world hour record next year. He held the record briefly a couple of the years ago, well, last year, wasn't it, before Bradley Wiggins broke it in June.
You know, I hate to correct you, Lionel, but there was a Women's Madison at the recent European Championships. I know you mentioned their World Cup, World Championship, but
I did. That's FYI. Why.
Can
that
I
was,
also
that was actually
something.
Why I. Oh, here we go.
Can I also correct something?
Yeah,
Lionel, I think you said that we gathered that the Champions League of track cycling, the first event has been cancelled due to poor ticket sales. We think that's the reason, but I think the organisers have disputed that and they've suggested that it's something to do with logistics. What role logistics could play in a cycling stadium, I'm not sure. But talking of cycling stadiums, chaps, I've got a question. There's a new race, the Tempo race. What does that entail precisely?
Well, Daniel, it's funny you should ask about the Tempo race because it, of course, now features in the revamped Omnium. And the Tempo race, from the top of my head, is run over 10 kilometres for men and 7.5 kilometres for women. It's a bunch race. It features a sprint on every lap after the first five laps, with the first rider across the line winning 2 points and the second getting 1 point. Any lap rider must leave the race. So it forms part of the Omnium. That's just off the top of my head.
I hate to sort of break character here and just say that the Track World Cup was broadcast live on the BBC over the whole of the weekend, so our listeners will probably have watched it.
And Eurosport.
And we'll probably know more about it, and we'll perhaps expect us to have talked about, you know, who won and how the tactics went and that kind of thing. And as I didn't see a moment of it because I was doing other stuff, I don't know whether just...
Well, I watched the Women's Madison, and I saw Katie Archibald and Manon Lloyd win that race in quite sensational fashion. Katie Archibald went down heavily and Manon Lloyd went down as well. And Katie Archibald broke her wrist, and that only she only realised that later. I guess it hurt at the time, but she was in phenomenal form, Katie Archibald. And her presence there, I guess, helped explain the sellout crowd. It was absolutely packed. And you know, you were talking about the first Champions League, Revolution Champions League in Paris being cancelled. We don't know for sure whether it was the lack of ticket sales, but certainly ticket prices were slashed reportedly in the days before that decision was taken, which suggested they were trying to shift a lot of tickets, which suggests that there were a lot of tickets left. But you know, it does underline, I think, that this, you know, fanatical interest in track cycling is a uniquely British phenomenon. And so now the two Revolution Champions League meetings will be held in the UK, in Manchester and London.
Well, it's as British as cyclocross is Belgian, isn't it? And, you know, the common factor there being that it's dominated by British riders, I suppose. And it just goes to show again that patriotism tends to hold sway, doesn't it? We've talked about this. When did we talk about this recently? We didn't quite get into our usual ding-dong over patriotism, Rich, but we did talk about this in a recent podcast. I think it was about we were talking about the Sky issue, weren't we? And reaction to the Sky pseudo-scandal recently. I was actually going to ask you about Sky and the ongoing ramifications of that story. You said you saw Sir Dave Brailsford at the Ruler Classic. What kind of reception did he get, and what kind of, was he answering questions about the Wiggins affair, or
there was no mention of any jiffy bags on stage at the Ruler Classic. He kept a pretty low profile. He was on stage with Michał Kwiatkowski, the vanity signing, and Luke Rowe, very much not a vanity signing. Luke Rowe was in good form. He was funny. It was mainly the event was mainly to unveil the new Team Sky jersey.
Very, very, they've really ripped up the design handbook there, haven't they?
Yeah,
with the design
totally
of the Sky jersey.
The color, and
it's unlike last year and the year before and the year before. Next year's Sky jersey will be very much black,
predominantly black,
with
yeah.
white and sky blue. A lot of people asking about the contents of the jiffy bag. Those lines on the front are actually Morse code, which if you translate it into English from Morse code, dots and dashes, it will actually tell you. It will reveal what was in the jiffy bag.
There are lines on the jersey, as Lionel says, which denote victories over the 6 year or however long Team Sky have been going. Each line represents one victory. And we did come up with a suggestion that we should do a second podcast jersey T-shirt with lines to denote the best meals that Lionel has had.
Hmm.
with the lines actually made out of stains from those meals. That might be available next year.
So what, sort of dots and dashes of sauce, gravy?
Mm. Bit of chicken from Bourg-en-Bresse, yeah. If we can afford it. But yeah, the Roulard Classic, I mean, going back to your question, Daniel, no, there wasn't, you know, it was a very, it wasn't really that sort of occasion. I think one of the issues with the Roulard Classic, you know, this was the second year of the event. It's a cross between a sort of theatre spectacular with, you know, lots of very high profile speakers on a stage.
Was theatre's Ned Bolting there?
He was hosting some of the events, and then sort of exhibition space where lots of brands exhibited. And it seemed to me this year and last year that the auditorium, if I can call it that, there wasn't as much sort of effort put into that as there was the exhibition space. And hearing what was being said on stage was a problem, and seeing what was happening on stage was a problem. And I think that, you know, there were huge crowds there. It was very popular. There's obviously an appetite for that sort of event, but they've got to sort out the acoustics and the way that the auditorium is laid out. You know, it's not enough just to have a room dedicated to speakers. I think that, you know, a bit more effort needs to be put into making sure speakers can be seen and heard. And that was a problem during the Sky event. It was an even bigger problem when they had Christian Prudhomme on stage, which was a real shame because Prudhomme certainly said some interesting things from what I could gather about La Course as well, about the women's event at the Tour de France next year, which is obviously a short mountain stage. And he made a sort of a case for arguing that represented progress from the previous circuit race on the Champs-Élysées. I think a lot of people will disagree with that. But
what was the case that he made, Rich?
Well, I struggled to hear it, but I certainly heard him.
He just looked very animated.
He did look very animated. The mics stopped working during that event, so they ended up Ned Bolting and Christian Prudhomme basically shouting from the stage. Prudhomme, he just felt that the women contesting a mountain stage in the Alps was a progressive step from the Champs-Élysées, and that it would, you know, be a better race and a greater spectacle. That was the argument he made. As I say, a lot of people disagree with him. The big draw there, apart from Jan Ullrich, who was there, the big draw was obviously Filippo Pozzato, who was there, and he was on stage a couple of times. And on the Friday, I think it was, I had a quick chat with a friend of the podcast, Filippo Pozzato, friend, of course, of Ciro Scogna Emilio, our Italian friend. Here is Pippo Pozzato.
You want to interview the maestro?
The maestro, very quickly, yeah. Filippo, first of all, what do you think of this event? First time you've been at the Roulard Classic, what are your impressions?
Yeah, it's very, very cool show. I like it too much, but I have only one problem, because I don't feel good because Ciro is not with me. This is my big problem here.
Well, they've missed a trick, haven't they? They should have. Why is Ciro not here?
I don't know. I think it's possible if... I hope he's working, but when he don't working, it's not good for me. Ciro's don't stay here.
Maybe he's too expensive.
But it's not a problem for Ciro, this.
Maybe you should have subsidized his trip here.
When Ciro have a problem, I pay the ticket for Ciro. And Ciro, please come here, because London without you is not London.
It's just not the same. Filippo, you were on stage earlier. Tell us about your bike collection. You have an incredible collection of bicycles. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I love the bicycle, and now I have, 26, 27 bicycle, and I hope I have more new bicycle for my friend or great big champion.
So are they bicycles that you've had in your career, or are they bikes that you've ridden, or are you collecting other bikes as well?
No, my career and another guys I have taken, and now I want to... One new Villier limited edition for 110 year, for celebrate 110 year, and after is possible one old bicycle I want to buy for my collection.
Where do you keep them all?
I put in Italy in one big my small museum. I have not only the bicycle, I have the shoes. Every shoes I ever use, the particular pins and the jersey I have used when I stay baby. I starting. I have one the only here.
I mean, you've been a professional for a long time. Do you still enjoy cycling and the bike as much as ever?
Yeah, I like it too much, the bicycle, and I enjoy when it's possible I ride every day. It's not like the first year, but when you stay in professional, you training every day, you stay for the race, is for you love the bicycle, and I enjoy every time myself when I ride the bicycle.
What do you look forward to next year, 2017? Is it the Giro again, or what?
I hope the first big classic.
Milan-San Remo.
I hope it's my dream when I stay baby. I have winner one time. I doing second, third, five. I stay in the front and breakaway in the last kilometer one year. And I hope it's possible for the last year of my career, winner my dream.
Is next year going to be your last year?
Normally, yeah. Not for sure, but normally yes. I want to finish with a big victory, and when it's possible, finish like Fabian is a great idea.
Good luck.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And next time maybe we'll get people Ciro along.
Yeah, for sure. And when I want to come to London with Ciro.
Eurosport, the home of cycling.
Thank you very much to Eurosport for their sponsorship of the cycling podcast. Very grateful to them. Coming up on Eurosport, still more cycling. There's the UCI Track Cycling World Cup Round 2 in Apeldoorn, a place we know well, of course, from the Giro d'Italia this year. That's on Sunday, the 13th of November, and it's live on Eurosport 2 between 1 and 4:30. That's day 3 of the World Cup. Also coming up on Eurosport, Revolution Series Champions League meetings, round 1 in Manchester on Saturday the 26th of November, round 2 in London on Saturday the 3rd of December, and also the Ghent 6 day, the final day of the Ghent 6 is live actually on Eurosport 2 on Sunday the 20th of November between 1 and 5 o'clock, 1 p.m. and 5 o'clock. So we heard there before the break from Pippo Pozzato, who told us all about his plans to win Milan-San Remo and also about his bike collection.
He's a charismatic fellow, isn't he? We doorstepped him a bit on our way out of the Ruler Classic.
Well, you were desperate for a picture with Lionel.
I was. Well, I think you know, there's a yin and yang there, isn't there? His hair is so marvellous and lustrous, and mine is non-existent.
I was surprised you didn't lean over and sort of try and plaster some of it to your head.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, like
the
pull
old,
it across.
The old Hamlet advert, you know, Gregor Fisher.
Yeah, what would it be like to have that hair?
It did sound rather like you were plotting a burglary, Richard, in that interview. When you were quite insistent about him telling you where his bike collection was located. And he didn't buy it, did he?
Yeah, now you mention it.
Italy, you mention it.
Maybe that is how it came across.
The thing about Pozzato, it's really quite heartwarming to know that he's collected his, got all his bikes, got a big collection of bikes, keeps all of his race shoes and kit, and a real fanatic. It's clear that he's very much more in love with the idea of being a professional cyclist than actually being a professional cyclist. He's embraced the kind of the culture of it and the lifestyle of it, but he's been a professional cyclist in name only, really, for the last few years, hasn't he?
But they're harsh but fair. I mean, you say the great thing about Filippo Pozzato. I mean, you know, he's a bit of a friend of the podcast. We have turned him into a bit of a cult figure. There are some slightly more unsavory sides to his history as a professional cyclist. You know, kind of ganged up on Filippo Simeone, who was part of the group of riders that ganged up against Filippo Simeone in 2004. He has acknowledged that he's worked with Michele Ferrari. However, the one endearing thing about Filippo Pozzato is that he has embraced the joke that is Filippo Pozzato, and he's his own biggest sort of, well, he pokes fun at himself more than anyone else, I think.
Yeah, the character that he's created as well on social media, etc. You created that famous World social media champions jersey for him, didn't you, Daniel, about a year ago? Posted that on Twitter.
Still got it on my desktop, I think.
But he has embraced that, and he's stoked it and encouraged it. And, you know, there was that great moment at the Giro last year when he clipped off the front and he almost won that stage that Roger Kluger won. I can't remember where we were, but somewhere in Italy. And you know, as he came across the line and he rode into Ciro Scognamiglio, Ciro had been quite concerned. And as he told him, you know, what are you doing, Filippo? You almost spoiled the joke, and you know, by winning. And Pozzato totally seems to get that, which is endearing. He's, you know, there are other collectors. I mean, Bradley Wiggins is a collector of stuff.
Eric Zabel, famously. Eric Zabel's got dozens or possibly hundreds of bikes. I think mainly his own, but still.
But he is a marketing man's dream, though, isn't he, Pozzato? I mean, at the Giro, the Willia bus was the one. They changed their name, didn't they, halfway through, or on the eve of the Giro. But their bus was mobbed every day without fail. He was certainly one of the most popular riders with the public. And although he hasn't won a race since the 2013 Grand Prix West France.
Good knowledge.
Yeah, well, I had to look it up. I mean, I didn't just have that there on the top of my head. He remains very engaging, very popular with the fans, and they made the most of him, really, didn't they, Willia? Because every morning he'd go to the sign-on at the Giro on that retro bike with the chrome forks and you know, the 1980s equipment on it. I think it is a 1980s bike that he was riding. So, you know, they kind of, you know, use him in a way that sort of gets the most out of the cult of Filippo Pozzato, because he's certainly not going to be winning any bike races anytime soon, and I won't be wasting a euro betting on him winning Milan-San Remo next year.
No, it's good that professional cycling has characters like him, that they're not all, you know, robotic, power meter driven. He's a bit colourful. We want people like that. Well, chaps, I was away in Gran Canaria last weekend, as you know, with Alberto Contador, and I think you were going to ask me about that, were you not? You're not interested to know how that went?
Well, I want to know how you got on with the 100-something kilometres of riding you had to do every day.
Yeah, it was a lot of riding. It was a 5-day trip. I have to say thanks to Polar Tech who laid it on. It was actually a global competition that they ran for cyclists to enter a competition whereby they had to tot up their monthly bike riding. I think there was a minimum of 1,000 kilometres. If you did 1,000 kilometres, you were eligible to be selected to go on this trip. And there were 10... people from all around the world. Colombia, there was an Austrian lady representing the UK, there was a Polish lady representing Switzerland, but, you know, there was French, Germans, Dutch, Spanish, Italian winners of this competition. So they were all there, and it was primarily for them, the event. But there was a lot of bike riding on it.
Didn't Alberto Contador ride away from you up a very steep hill on one leg?
He did. I spent a lot of time riding with his brother, Fran Contador, who's also his manager. And it's fair to say that Fran didn't get the Contador cycling genes. They were all pretty much concentrated in Alberto. Or he just doesn't have time to train, because his level of fitness was very similar to mine. So we spent a lot of time together, and at one point, one of the big climbs, Alberto, having reached the top. Now, he registered for Strava for the first time in his life for this, for these few days riding in Gran Canaria. And if you go on Strava, you will not see the name Alberto Contador. He actually registered himself as Faustino Munoz, his mechanic. So his sort of aging mechanic now holds several Strava records, I think, in Gran Canaria. So that is actually Alberto Contador. I hope I'm not giving away any secrets there. But he was there. Ivan Basso was there riding. Jesus Hernandez, his longtime friend and teammate, was there riding as well. But yeah, one of the climbs, Contador came back having reached the top and rode with us a little bit, and then unclipped one leg and rode away riding with just his right leg for a significant amount of time. Then he swapped legs and carried up powering away on the other leg. I mean, I knew he was quite good at cycling, but it was quite humbling, humiliating to see it in action like that. Body, upper body completely still. It was pretty impressive.
I can see potential here for Velon. You know, maybe they could have in certain races, they could have a one-legged kilometre where you have to unclip one foot and pedal with only one leg for a kilometre. Liven up some racing.
You're into these novelty ideas, aren't you?
just anything. Just let's
liven up. I have to say, Contador, he spoke a lot to the group. He was very open. It's very interesting on bikes. He said the best bike he'd ever ridden was in 2009, the year he won the Tour de France, of course, which was a Trek. He goes back on Trek next year.
What a surprise! Yeah. Anyway, go on.
Yeah, but he was interesting on bikes. We know that he's got a bit of an obsession with his equipment, and that was borne out by the sort of detail that he went into about his bikes, and they're quite interesting. The other people who were there were members of his under 23 team, the Contador Foundation team. Did some interviews with some of those guys. It's run by Fran Contador, and it's a very interesting project. Very interesting project, in fact. I didn't really know much about it before I went, and that will feature in a future episode of the Cycling Podcast, which we'll focus on some of the under 23 projects that are out there, the development teams that are out there. So listen out for that. Do you want to hear from Contador? I did speak to him. I grabbed a quick interview with him. We don't often hear from him speaking in English. There aren't any earth-shattering revelations in this, but it's quite interesting to hear him, I think.
Yeah, let's play Alberto Contador.
What's the biggest thing that drives you now? You mentioned the Tour de France there. Is that the thing that sort of fires you, motivates you more than anything else at the moment?
The Tour de France is the more big race in the world. Is the race that have a more big impact for all the sponsor and for the people, and it's the race that changes your life when you win for one time, no? And then the final one, big part of the budget of one team is for the tour, and then for this at the final you need more or less always put the big objective of the year, the Tour de France.
Is that the reason why you changed your mind about retiring? Was it this desire to win one more tour?
It's for different things, no? But the first of all is because my level is high, is continue at the same level, and the training camp sometimes better because they know with the watts you can look your level with respect to other years. Other second is that all the people when ask to me why I go. And the third at the final was, okay, if I have a passion for my work, I enjoy in the race, why don't continue? And when I take this decision, of course, one of the things of the objective is try to win the Tour de France. I think if I win the Tour de France, will be the best moment for finishing in the cycling.
Was it a hard decision to go back on your decision to retire? Was it something you thought about a lot this year?
No. Yeah. Was progressive, no? Race by race, month by month, with the feeling and also with the people, no, that is around me, and at the final. After Pays Basque, I take the decision. I take the decision of continue.
Would you have to change the way that you race to win another Tour de France? You think we saw this year at the Vuelta, for example. You know, when you were on Covadonga, when you attacked and you really blew the race apart. But maybe that was racing in the old style of Contador. Would you have to race in a more pragmatic way?
No, I hope the next year are other tactic. This year in the world I don't feel good from the first day. Finishing the tour with a big problems, need to stop for a long time for recover. And after at the final go to two races, San Sebastian and Burgos, and don't do a good training camp or good planification in my opinion. Was not very good, maybe the best training before the Vuelta, and then when I arrived there, maybe because I'm also a little tired from the tour, but don't feel good in the Vuelta.
Have you had a chance to look at the route for the tour next year? What do you think of it?
Yeah, I look. I like that the time trials are not very bad for me. This is a good point, in special with respect to Froome. And for the rest, I think that will be maybe more open for different tactics with respect to other years. When you have a very hard final, you have maybe one team very strong and put one high tempo, and anybody can attack. No, think if you have some descent and these things, maybe it can give more option for possible attacks.
Who's the toughest rival you've had in your career?
I think in every moment, in one moment you have one, another moment you have other. No, the first part of my career is Andy Schleck. Was the one guy with a big class, and in the tour, yeah, was very hard with him. And now, it's Froome and the Team Sky, because at the final, if you fight with one rider, you can lose or you can win, but with one very strong team, it's more hard. It's more hard, especially in this moment of the cycling. And then, for the second part of my career, Froome.
So that was Alberto Contador. I did ask him at the end whether he would miss Oleg Tinkoff in 2017. Tinkoff, of course, recently gave an interview where he was very critical indeed of Contador. Contador said in response to that question that he was still a Tinkoff rider until the 31st of December. And presumably he's due another two pay packets. But he did. I said, will I ask you again on the 1st of January? He laughed at that. But I don't know that I'm going to have an opportunity to ask him on the 1st of January.
What, New Year's Day?
It's unlikely.
Well, you'll be hungover and he'll be training. So
that's true.
Tinkoff's comments were rather lacking in class, weren't they? He criticised Contador for being too serious, too boring, not drinking enough champagne and all this kind of thing. And when you're paying multi-millions of euros a year, I would have thought that you'd want your assets to be serious and focused on the job.
It was interesting. I mean, even in those few days, end of the season, this is his time off. It was fascinating to just observe Contador and see how meticulous he is about everything. He was riding a specialised bike with disc brakes, so obviously taking the opportunity to try those. I don't think he was very impressed with them, actually. He did talk at one point about throwing the bike over the side of the mountain, which didn't suggest he liked them that much. But even just little things, like I noticed him putting on sun cream one morning and the way that he was applying it and around scars in particular, in a very meticulous way. And you have this sense with Contador that he's very precise and everything is thought about, and he is still incredibly dedicated to his profession, which ultimately I think is why he's carrying on. And this was borne out as well by the special that we did recently, the Friends special, the last one that we did on Contador, with interviews with some of the people around him and people he's come into contact with over the years. He is the professional's professional, and we know, of course, there's a history. He's served a doping ban, and he comes from an era and from teams that certainly have pretty murky past. There's that element, that aspect to the Contador story. But the guy, that there is a lot to admire about him, and I think Tinkoff apart, I think he is quite admired within the sport by other riders and other teams.
Yeah, I think he is, and I think we've spoken in the last few months about his dealings with the press, or I think the special we did on Alberto Contador, our American colleague Andy Hood spoke about that, how he's utterly professional in the way he deals with us. You talked about Tinkoff being a bit graceless in his remarks. On the other hand, some of what Tinkoff said did chime with what, for example, Johan Bruneel said in our Contador special. He talked about the fact that Contador really creates almost like a vacuum-packed capsule within a team which comprises his entourage. So that's his brother, that's Jacinto Vidarte, his press guy, Munoz, his mechanic. And, and that has actually expanded. Next year he's going to take a couple of other guys to, well, Steven de Jong has incorporated that group in the last few years, the Directeur Sportif, and then he's also taking Basso with him to Trek. So it will be interesting. I mean, there's going to be a big turnover next year at Trek. There are a lot of riders leaving and a lot of riders coming on board, and it will just be interesting to see how that meshes together, because Trek have got another rider, a charismatic rider who's a big character and who's going to be a leader who's arriving. That's John Degenkolb. So they have to find the blend there, and Contador also has to prove that he's still able to compete in the Tour de France.
Well, Contador, in the group sessions, the group discussions, where he was a little bit more open than he was with me when I had the tape recorder on, he talked about, there was a sort of veiled, not criticism, but just observation, really, that going to the Tour de France with Peter Sagan and him, you know, with these two aims, it is not the way to try and win the Tour. Of course, he had the crashes as well, which ultimately ruled him out. But he spoke an awful lot about Sky and about their tendency to go to the Tour with one focus and with five or six riders who can be among the last men in the mountains. And he sounded quite defeatist, actually, when he spoke about the firepower that Sky have. Not just Froome, not the leader, but the people around him. And certainly spoke about the challenge of trying to match that in terms of personnel and money, you know, and it does, in his view, it boils down a lot to money.
I don't think they will be able to match Sky or come anywhere close in the Tour next year. I mean, there're going to be some good riders at Trek, and there's some good riders coming with Contador. Jesus Hernandez is going with him, and then they've got Pantano arriving, who won a stage in the Tour de France. And then I think Michael Gogol, who was also at Tinkoff, is going to be a big he's going to be a big help to Contador in the mountains. Is going to be key, but they certainly haven't got a long list of potentials, domestiques deluxe, in the same way that Sky do. And as I said, they're going to have to incorporate Degenkolb, you would think, even into the Tour team. I mean, Contador is going to be younger next year's Tour de France, I think I'm right in saying, than Cadel Evans was when he won the Tour de France. So a priori, he's not too old. And, you know, I also think he showed enough this year to suggest that his physical capacities aren't dwindling quickly. I mean, you just look at his performance in time trials, for example, and time trialing is often something that goes quite, or it's one of the first things to go, it can be, in general classification riders. And, you know, he won a time trial at the Tour of the Basque Country, he performed well elsewhere. And I think it was more actually in the mountains where he looked, well, certainly a bit of a shadow of his former self, or certainly not able to make the difference in the same way that
he would argue that we didn't see him at his best in the mountains. You know, he won the Tour of the Basque Country against Quintana, and that was a very good result. At the Tour de France, of course, he crashed early, so we didn't see him at anywhere near his best in the Tour de France. And then, as he said in the interview there, he felt that he was certainly below par in the Vuelta.
He was a bit below par in the Vuelta, and he rode very aggressively at times, perhaps too aggressively given his condition. There was that stage where he did seem to have people on the ropes and then went backwards very, very quickly after putting in several of his trademark. That's right, yeah, several of his trademark out of the saddle accelerations, which are very exciting to watch. But I can't help thinking that if he's going to win another Tour de France, he's going to have to race it in a real sort of pragmatic Tour de France style way, rather than in an Alberto Contador type way. Try and save all of that effort for when it really counts, and it sounds slightly dull, but when it really counts is in the last 1500 metres of the uphill finishes, not the last 5 or 6 kilometres. The days of him, you know, riding away from people and putting in big time he still has that speed in his legs to cause some real damage if he applies it at exactly the right time.
Yeah, I was going to say, Lionel, I mean, what does that more pragmatic approach look like? Because I think we've all sort of said and agreed over the last few years that the best chance Contador has in Grand Tours is one of these spectacular ambushes that certainly at the start of the end of his career, so 2012 in the Vuelta at Fuente Day, that was what won him that race, and increasingly that's looked like the way things have to go for him, that he's not going to win Grand Tours the way that Chris Froome wins them, by overpowering everyone with a strong team and by being the strongest in the mountain. So What does a Contador victory in the Tour de France look like? I think that's the difficult thing for him.
Well, yeah, I think the big ambush is the real 100-to-1 shot, isn't it? Whereas with the strength he has, if he measures that same effort out over, you know, all of the important days, following when he needs to follow and just chipping away, not losing the race, first of all, by either crashing. I mean, it sounds blooming obvious, but it's exactly right. You know, he's been undone so many times in recent years by crashes and misfortune, But you kind of make your own misfortune, you know, you make your own luck, don't you? If you've been caught out so many times in similar circumstances that it's almost, you know, it's not a misfortune, it's, you know, misadventure, really. I think if he were to just curb that attacking instinct and save it for the very end of stages, he could chisel away sort of 15, 20 seconds here and there rather than looking to try and gain sort of a minute and a half with something spectacular.
Well, if that's the case, I think the ideal blueprint, he gave himself the ideal blueprint way back in 2008 when he rode that Giro d'Italia famously, having been hauled off a beach a week before and really didn't attack very much at all in that Giro and just rode very conservatively because he had to, because he didn't have the condition to ride aggressively, and maybe that's the way he has to do it. But of course everything depends on the competition, and you know,
kind of similarly in 2015 when he won the Giro as well, he was up against a very strong Astana team with two riders who looked like they could win, and he rode, albeit he was maybe slightly below par with the shoulder injury after an early crash, and that maybe curbed his attacking instincts a little bit. But he rode that in a relatively, for Contador, a relatively conservative, defensive way, didn't he?
He did, yeah. I mean, it all depends, of course, on the competition, and you know, luck, as always, will play its part. Who else is going to crash? Who else is going to come in under strength? And you know, he might, in one of these Grand Tours, he's not got many left, he might only have one left, he might find himself on the right end of that that kind of knife edge that is fortune.
So we've discussed Filippo Pozzato, we've discussed Alberto Contador. What's next, chaps?
Well,
Davide Rebelli.
I was just going to say, we mentioned there that, you know, Contador was the subject of our last friend's special, and we've got two more to release this year, coming up very soon. 2020 Vision, which is our glance into the future crystal ball stuff with interviews with some of the stakeholders in professional cycling. Is that US marketing guy back there almost? Will he be in
back
it? US marketing guy.
What does US marketing guy make of the last night's events, Lionel?
He won the election. US marketing guy.
US marketing guy is president of the United States,
the
most powerful
of the
man in the world. He's going to revive the Tour de Trump, great stage race from the early 90s, I think 89 and 90, the Tour de Trump, which was going to be bigger than the Tour de France. We made a little episode about that during the Tour de France this year, Kilometre Zero, the political cycle, where I tried to marry up the twin themes of the Tour de France, Brexit, and Donald Trump. Never for a moment did I think Donald Trump was going to win the election, nor did Greg LeMond think Trump would win the election. He was pretty scathing about Trump in that episode. You can go back and listen to the political cycle if you want on our website, thecyclingpodcast.com, or find it on Audio Boom.
Well, to continue the plugging, which I was doing, 2020 Vision that's coming out very soon. November the 25th, I think, is the release of that.
Yeah, let's tie ourselves down to a date.
November the 25th for that one, and then about a week or so later, December the 9th, I believe, is Bradley Wiggins Full Circle. And we're off to Ghent next week to finish off the recording of that special episode. Bradley Wiggins, of course, is riding that.
Is that
with
Champions
Mark
League,
Cavendish.
Chaps?
No, that's a six-day indoor track cycling.
Is there a
stadium
tempo
cycling
race?
I don't think there is a tempo race.
I'm cottoning
on. No, there isn't.
Very fast.
You are, yeah.
Getting the hang of this.
You went to the Ghent 6 last year, Daniel. Didn't you enjoy it? You enjoyed
it. Faux naivety.
Anyway, we're going there, and that will be a lot of you have become friends of the Cycling Podcast. Thank you very much for that. But you can become one if you're not at thecyclingpodcast.com. It'll get you access to all our 2016 specials. There are 10 of them there, including a little bonus one. And we'll very soon be launching our 2017 Friends special program. Slightly different, but not really. Substantially different, but there'll be a couple of different options there. And, you know, hopefully you can sign up again and support the Cycling Podcast and the work that we do and us going to races, etc. That's what it helps to support.
Well, yeah, we'll be unveiling our 2017 race plan fairly shortly, won't we? Before Christmas, I would have thought, will we? Yes, we will.
We will unveil all that before Christmas.
Whoever you are, wherever you ride, whatever the reason, Rafa exists to improve your ride. With the finest kit, inspiring stories, and vibrant clubhouses and communities all over the world.
Thank you very much indeed to our friends Rafa for supporting the cycling podcast. We've got an event coming up in Rafa. I think it sold out actually on the 30th of November.
It was free, wasn't it? So it hasn't quite sold out, but all tickets have gone.
All tickets have gone, and I think some people are on waiting lists. I hope that some of you can get in.
Has our Edinburgh event sold out?
I don't know if Edinburgh event sold out. That's on the 1st of December, Thursday, the 1st of December. Both these events are, if you search for thecyclingpodcast.com live events, you will find them. And I think there are tickets still available for Edinburgh. So that's on the 1st of December. And we'll be joined by Francois Thomazeau. And we'll be joined in London by Francois as well. And also Jonathan Vauters.
And by me, no?
And by Daniel Freeb. Yeah, well, that's taken as read, Daniel.
Well, I'm not in Edinburgh, am I?
You're not coming to Edinburgh, no. But you will be in London. Yeah. Yep. So that's maybe why the tickets went so quickly.
And why we haven't sold out in Edinburgh.
That's why we haven't maybe sold out in Edinburgh, though I think we're pretty close to it from when I last heard.
We're taking the cardboard cut out of Daniel, are we?
We could do, yeah. Got to make more sense out of it, yeah. if we can get its hair on the train. but Edinburgh, we're playing. We're speaking in the Signet Library, which is an amazing venue, and really looking forward to that. That'll be quite a thrill, I think.
Indeed. What else have we got? Richard, before we move on, actually, I just wanted to mention something. Anyone who listened to our Mont Ventoux special, which I made in June, we released during the Tour de France. It was called Mont Ventoux, Heat, Wind and Fire. And it featured some music by a chap called James Welsh, who creates music under the name Camera. And he very kindly allowed us to use his music in that episode because he'd been inspired to write an album after he rode Mont Ventoux. I think it was 20 times in 5 days. I think they rode it four times a day for 5 days running. We were very grateful to James for allowing us to use his music in the episode. Shortly after that, he got in touch with me to say that unfortunately his son Rory had been diagnosed with leukemia, and he has asked whether we could publicise an event which is happening on November the 19th. A friend of James's called Ben Wood is going to be riding up a hill called Brunthwaite Lane in Silsden, West Yorkshire, repeatedly. They're trying to Everest this climb, so I think they think Ben is going to be climbing it 60 times in 24 hours, which sounds like quite a difficult undertaking, and they are appealing for any cyclists who want to join in and keep Ben company as he makes this repeated effort on Brunthwaite Lane in Silsden, West Yorkshire. So anyone from that part of the world, Yorkshire, Lancashire, head over there on November the 19th. I think they're starting very early in the morning, maybe 4 o'clock in the morning. If anyone wants to donate, sponsor Ben, then if you go to Just Giving and put in the words Everest Murder Mile, that's Everest Murder Mile on Just Giving, we will be able to sponsor him. Good luck with that. It's for a great cause. It's for the Candlelighters Children's Cancer Charity.
Thank you for that, Lionel. We covered quite a lot of ground in this free-flowing, news-free week of the cycling podcast. Anything else you want to touch on there, Daniel?
No, not really. It's quite refreshing not to have any doping scandals, ridiculous behaviour, offensive interviews. I'm not sure.
I mean, there's all this stuff going on with the UCI and the World Tour, but we'll cover all that in the 2020 vision. That'll be quite focused on, you know, the politics, the structure, and how the sport is organised, and these are all big topics, aren't they, for a free floating week.
One thing I very much enjoy about this time of the year is that a lot of pro cyclists start doing some cross training because they don't ride their bikes for typically about a month, and a lot of them are on Strava. So it's a bit of a, for someone who doesn't really ride his bike anymore, i.e. me, but does run, it's quite a nice ego boost to see how thoroughly average a lot of them are at running. Of course, this time last year, we were talking about your prodigious athletic feats, weren't we, chaps? You were just starting the Trainer Road Challenge.
Well, I'm back on Trainer Road. Kicked off again just before my trip to Gran Canaria. I was fearing the worst out there, and it was sort of damage limitation, get a few sessions under my belt. And I'm enjoying it once more. I sit there on my, you know, in my back garden on my trainer road. I really enjoy it. I mean, last year we had a sense that we were being kind of watched, and there was a fear of missing a session and being judged for missing a session. So this year it's just really just for fun. And
we were being sponsored by Trainer Road, well, so we were obliged commercially to do
it. Which perhaps
explains why I've been so sluggish in getting back into it.
I remember I got a Jiffy bag in the post one day with the little the Bluetooth thing that I needed for my rear stay, and it was addressed Richard Moore, professional cyclist.
Wow.
And that was from you, Lionel.
What was in the Jiffy bag, Lionel?
But yeah, no, it's great fun. I sit there and listen to podcasts, not the cycling podcast, because I know what's in that. But what other podcasts do you listen to? I've been listening, going through the Adam Buxton back catalogue. I enjoy that.
The controversial Lance Armstrong.
Oh, do you listen to that?
I was asking you whether you listen to it.
I have listened to one or two of his, and I have to say I've enjoyed one or two of his. Ben Foster one was interesting.
Seal, I enjoyed. Interesting.
Crazy, but quite enjoyable. Chris Everett was good on the Lance Armstrong. The Malcolm Gladwell revisionist history is very good. And I think today of all days is a very good day to listen to the final one in his series on satire. Fascinating.
Should just explain that today of all days is the day after the US presidential election. Mm. Just for anyone who's listening to this.
The WTF podcast with Mark Maron. A bit hit or miss for me. He's sort of very highly regarded, but I don't always like his interview style. He did an interview with the fantastic harpist who Daniel and I have been seeing concert here in London, Joanna Newsom. It wasn't very good. He hadn't really done his homework on her. But I did listen to one more recently with Neil Young, and that was very enjoyable indeed. Neil Young was just great to listen to. Very soothing voice, Neil Young. Maybe we'll get him on the podcast. Any podcast you listen to, Daniel?
No, I mean, the direction this conversation has taken is starting to mimic one of the podcasts I was just telling you about before we came on air today, a German podcast called the Einschlafen Podcast, which is basically the Going to Sleep podcast, and it's designed to send you to sleep every night, which it does. It's boring by design. Anyway.
Great. Well, sorry about that. Can I just finally say one more podcast, the No Filter Photography podcast, which is by my brother Robin. It's really good.
The Moors are taking over podcasting here.
Listen to that one, No Filter Photography. It's really good. Well, if we've got nothing else to say, let's introduce our final interview. This ties in with next week will be episode 6 of the cycling podcast Femina. With myself and Orla Shinawee, and that's really a bumper interview one. It's got a retirement theme. We've spoken to a few riders who are stopping or retiring, but we've also got an interview with Laura Kenny, as she's now known, formerly known as Laura Trott. Orla interviewed her, really good, really interesting interview. We've also got Mara Abbott, the American rider who was fourth in the Olympic road race in an agonising finish. She's retired. Orla has interviewed her. We've got Jesse Walker, the young British rider who's come home from Italy pretty disillusioned and is stopping. She's only 22. Emma Johansson as well. I've got an interview with her, a retiring Swedish rider. I think that's it.
Packed, absolutely packed.
Really packed.
There'll be no room for you in there.
There's a bit of room for us.
There's always room for the buffalo.
A little bit of room for it.
Charges in, doesn't
bit
he?
Of Bants in there as well. So, yeah.
So what have we got now?
It's good. What?
What have we got now?
We've got an interview with Megan Garnier, who was the inaugural winner of the Women's World Tour this year. American rider came over to the Ruler Classic, and Orla grabbed her for a quick chat. Here she is.
So we're here at the Ruler Classic, the last morning of the event. Megan Garnier has flown over from the States, is that right, to collect a special award. Tell us why you're at the event, Megan.
This year they have, after the inaugural Women's World Tour, they're also, Vox Women is having a Voxy Women's Rider Award. And I won that for 2016, so I'm honoured to be here.
It's been a phenomenal year for you, Megan, topping the Women's World Tour, the inaugural one, as you say. We were just chatting a moment ago, and you were saying that other people have been asking, has it been a bit of a whiplash moment? But as you said to me, it's been steady progress, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's been an incredible year, but at the same time, it's been step by step, and every year it's just been a little bit better and a little bit more, and with this past season, of course, there's been increased pressure, but throughout my entire career, it's been slowly gaining. And then you just learn how to deal with the pressure, how to accept the interviews, how to accept graciously winning and enjoy winning as well.
Have you found an increase in media attention and public attention, I guess, consolidated by the fact that we've had a Women's World Tour for the first time?
Yeah, this year we've had a lot of races that have either been live streamed or we've had 6 to 30 minute recaps of the races, and that really helps our sport. Help the media attention helps get the word out on how dynamic and interesting our sport can be.
And yet there were hopes. I understand that it could have been so much more than that.
Yeah, I mean, we always want more, right? That's what's driving our sport forward. But at the same time, you can always turn on the TV in Europe and find a men's race, and hopefully someday that's where our sport will be as well.
Because for the races to have signed up to the Women's World Tour, the original stipulation really was that they were going to at least live stream the last hour of racing, isn't that right? What happened with that?
Yeah, that was originally part of the package to sign up to be a World Tour race, and we saw that at the beginning, and it kind of faded towards the end, and then it just became the recaps, which, again, is great for our sport, but at the same time, we would love to see more, and our fans would love to be able to follow our races live and along with the fans, get new viewership and new people interested in our sport and encourage more women to get out on bikes.
Because you were saying how your husband now used to have to follow your races on Twitter and whatnot, and he can now actually watch you, which is quite exciting. And we were chatting just before I pressed record on this, and you were saying that's often how women get into cycling, through their boyfriends, really.
Yeah, I mean, it's a large barrier to get into cycling. You have the equipment, and people always ask me, how do you get into cycling? And I just encourage you to just get out, get a bike, and get out there.
How did you get into cycling to begin with, then?
So I was a swimmer for 13 years, and I was dealing with a lot of shoulder problems as a swimmer. And I got to college and was doing so much physical therapy on top of the training for swimming that I said, this is too much. I'm not in college for swimming. I'm here for academics, and kind of retired from swimming, and thought I would do triathlon. So I started training for triathlon, and then that spring, somebody on my freshman dorm hall said, oh, you should come to a bike race. I did a bike race, loved it, and never went back.
What is it you love about it, then? What is it about the sport that drew you in and kept you there?
It's the antithesis of swimming, in that every day is different. You have every training day is different, whether it's the same loop, it's different weather. The sensations are different. You get to go all around the world and compete in all of these beautiful places and experience the culture. You're really in the culture. And you meet so many different people from all over the world that you never would have had the opportunity otherwise to have met.
What about your team this year? Done so incredibly well. And we discussed in the podcast in an earlier episode that it's almost like in the old days of the HTC Columbia lead out train. Other teams would look at them and think, how are they getting it right? What are they doing? And maybe in the team, you don't really know what you're doing right. It just works. Is there a sense of that, do you think?
Yeah, when I signed up with Bols Dolmans in the 2014 season, it was an up-and-coming team. It was in the women's peloton, but it wasn't one of the forces to be reckoned with. And Danny Stamm said, I want to be the number one team in the world. He's the director. And I said, okay, I'm on board with that. And he just has this ability to put together a group of women and it's just been natural, and on and off the bike, it's a great team. And I can't say that we know exactly how we play off each other, but in the race, we've been racing. The core group has been racing together now for 3 years, and it's this game, and it's the game that we know how our teammates are going to play.
How does the professionalism of Bols Dolmans rank compared to other teams? Because the women's peloton is still, there's a big disparity really between the top and the bottom, I guess, in terms of professionalism, and some girls who aren't even racing full time, for example.
We're very fortunate on Bols Dolmans. We're very well taken care of by our sponsors, and we're treated professionally. And I think it's been a really good example for how team should be built, and I think that's also part of being in the Dutch culture. They really have this incredible team. They have this vision of how a team should be, and I love about the Dutch culture as well. What you say you're going to get, and it's very clear.
One thing we were chatting about a moment ago as well was La Course for next year, and it seems to be a recurring theme in women's cycling, whereby we have high hopes of great things that will happen, like, for example, the Women's World Tour, where we thought it would be 1 hour of coverage of every race. Didn't happen to be the case, but progress nonetheless. Again, with La Course, we thought it might turn into a three-day race. It's simply been shifted to the mountains. How do you feel about the progress of that, or is it progress?
Yeah, I think La Course, we always want more, right? That's what is driving our sport. But at the same time, we want to be ready for it, and we want the riders to be ready for it. And I think the change in La Course is nice, and it's fresh. Instead of the same criterium-like course on the last day, it's fun. But we know kind of what's going to happen, and there's less excitement around it. So now we're getting a fresh course. It's going to feature different kinds of riders, and would have a good race on the Champs-Élysées. And then, but at the same time, we were talking about 3 days and how exciting that would be.
How far are we away from a 21-day race, do you think? And would you like to race in a 3-week Tour de France?
I would love to race a 3-week Tour de France. I think we're a ways off, because we do need more women that are racing full time, and then they don't have to worry about taking a week off or 2 weeks off for such a long race, because we do have quite a few women right now that are working as well as racing.
So Megan, you sit here as the number one rider in the world on the number one team in the world. What next for 2017? How can you better that?
Yeah, that's a good question. I haven't thought too much about 2017 because it's still the off season. I'm still trying to enjoy that.
Sorry, I should let you relax.
But yeah, I mean, we're not going to be complacent, and we have a strong team going in towards next year, and I know we'll be looking to for more wins.
Best of luck with it, Megan, and congratulations on a wonderful 2016.
Thank you.
So that was Megan Garnier, the winner of the Women's World Tour this year. We've covered quite a lot of that ground in the cycling podcast Femina, in terms of how the Women's World Tour might shake up women's cycling, and the importance of broadcasting in particular. I speak to a lot of people involved in women's cycling, and they talk about the, you know, how crucial it is to get TV coverage of the big races.
Rich, what's the feeling about her next year? Is she gonna, I mean, she didn't really dominate this year, but she dominated a part of the summer, didn't she, with her stage race wins in California and Italy. Do people expect more of the same next year?
Well, she had a real purple patch where she did seem quite dominant. I think the great thing about women's cycling now is it's quite unpredictable. Emma Johansson spoke about that, you know, there was a period of time where basically Marianne Vos would win every single race, and it's no longer the case that one rider dominates. I mean, Lizzie Armistead was pretty dominant at the start of the 2016 season, but you're tending now to see different riders excel in different terrain, and that's the sign of a pretty healthy sport. I mean, Megan Garnier is part of the Bulls Dolmans team, which was extremely strong this year, and they signed the Olympic champion Anna van der Breggen for next year, so they're not going to be any weaker in 2017. That's the one thing. There is a pretty dominant team there, but the sport as a whole is pretty healthy in terms of there being quite a wide selection of riders who can win different riders in different terrains. So things are looking quite good from that point of view, I think. So shall we wrap things up there? We've covered quite a lot for a podcast where we weren't really going to talk about very much.
Well, I have, yeah. Yeah.
Which I enjoyed talking about, yeah. Our labyrinthine ramblings.
Yeah. Mm. What else have we got coming up apart from the specials and the events? Have we got anything else to plug?
No, really. We're off, as I said earlier, we're off to Ghent next week for the 6 days. So we'll, next week's podcasting will
come from there, won't it?
Well, no, it might be the following week will come from the Ghent.
Okay,
six.
Yeah, we need to work out our
next
schedule,
week
don't
will
we?
Be the cycling podcast Femina, yeah, as previously mentioned.
Oh, we've got lunch with Charlie to schedule at some point.
Lunch
as
with
well.
Charlie Regalius. You had lunch with Charlie Regalius.
I
it's
did.
A new feature, Lunch with Lionel.
An irregular series.
That sounds quite scandalous. Lunch with Charlie. I didn't think you were into that kind of thing. Like, anyway.
Charlie with a Y. Charlie with a Y, Daniel.
All very innocent. A very, very delicious lunch. Won't spoil what we had. That'll be in the episode. Oh dear. Come on, let's wrap it up.
Let's finish.
Come on.
Okay.
Come on.
Thank you very much, Daniel. Speak to you next week.
Thank you. Bye, John.
Thanks, Lionel.
Thanks, Rich.
You've been listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more editions of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.